Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Joe Bennion is a potter. His wife, Lee, is a painter. They live in Spring City, Utah. It's a small town in the northern half of the San Pete Valley. Joe named his shop Horseshoe Mountain Pottery after the crescent-shaped ridge of the peak there in the distance. The city is known for preserving many of the original pioneer buildings and houses. It's also known for attracting a good number of artists.
Lee and I drove into Spring City 3 days after we were married. And it became very apparent that this is where we wanted to live. It's a quiet little place. At the time, there were about 400 residents. Largely rural agricultural, up in the mountains. One LDS ward. I guess you could say it was a wide spot in the road. It had the qualities that we were looking for. That would have been July of 76. And yes, the artist community has grown over the years. More artists have come, some have left. But the town has grown, and it has definitely got a reputation as an artist community and as a National Historic District. We've lived here 47, 48 years. We've raised three children here who have grown up and gone where they're going to go. I've served in the church. I've served on the city council, built a business here. And I think we're pretty well respected in the community by people who have been here and have known us. I've heard it said in biology that about every 7 years, every cell in your body is replaced. And that's happened many times over the years that we've lived here. We're embedded. We're part of the soil of this place. But something's changed. Our lives will never be the same again.
Now, here's where the story turns. Joe Bennion told us about 2.5 years ago, he got a call from his attorney, who also happens to be his son-in-law, Caleb. Caleb called to tell him, as he put it, there's a storm coming. Coming from a website, a Substack in Fountain, Florida, run by a man named Jamin Darcy. Darcy said there was a ring of Satan worshipers in Spring City who ritualistic abused and tortured and murdered children. Darcy had read about some statements from this case in 2012 that had never been verified, and the case was eventually closed, but these statements were graphic and horrifying, and about 140 people had been named, among them Lee and Joe.
And at the time, it just didn't seem real to me. And as I started looking into some of the things out there on social media, I realized people all over the country are seeing this. Early on, we just kind of figured this would blow over. But then I would have someone in the community approach me and say, "Hey, Joe, my daughter saw this thing on YouTube, and it's about you, and it's really awful." I told her, "I don't believe it," and we would talk about it. And then I got a completely anonymous email, and it was somebody just really laying it on me how evil I am. And I've gotten people posting very bad reviews about me on Google Business. And then someone just sent me a Facebook Messenger message, and it was somebody who used their own name, somebody who I'd watched grow up, and just said, "I know who you are and I know what you've done." It's very surreal. Dreamlike. And it's a bad dream. It's a dream that I wish I could wake up from. Apparently someone organized a protest here in Spring City, and they wound up at my pottery shop. That was actually a protest about me. One of the people involved in it was a friend and a neighbor. And, of course, I've had to install locks at my pottery shop and surveillance cameras. And, you know, for 45 years, I never locked that shop. It was open 24/7 because they have been in my shop. They've posted pictures inside my shop online. I haven't had to deal with needing to be defensive in the past, and now it's a fact of life for us. When I wake up in the morning, it's quite often the first thing I think about. It's beginning to dominate. And at the same time, I don't feel any guilt or any dread. I didn't do anything, and I can hold my head up anywhere because I know who I am. And I know where I am with God, and I know this isn't true. When the articles came out in the Sanpete Messenger and the Salt Lake Tribune, people reached out to us and said, well, I guess you're really glad that that's behind you now. And it's not. We're still going deeper into it. But I take a lot of comfort in the fact that those who have known us for 3 or 4 or going on 5 decades trust us and believe us. But, you know, Spring City has grown. There's a lot of new people here. There's some people here that have never gotten to know us. My sense is we're going to stay. And part of that is because I love this place. I love the people. But also, I have spent the last 40 years building up the idea of Horseshoe Mountain Pottery and Jill the Potter, happy at his craft. And if I were to move somewhere else, I would probably have to just quit being a potter, because I'm too old now to go somewhere else and build that sort of reputation up. It's not even about monetizing my craft. It's about enjoying what I do, loving the feel of clay, loving the contact with people, loving knowing that people have my things in their homes and are using them, and they send me pictures of the fresh bread they've baked. One of the most priceless things I have, that trust, that relationship, that thing that develops between the maker and the user, and that interplay. Even though I might not ever meet these people, I have had my hands in the clay. I have brought these vessels up from the wheel and put them into someone's hands, and they take them, and they have a beautiful experience with it. I feel that deep connection to the people who use the product of my hands and the product of my life. I want to stay here and continue that. But I know that, you know, my life will not ever be the same. And that's just something that really can't be given back to me.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to try and piece this story together because there are a lot of dimensions to it, the legal ones, the political ones, and there's a moral one here too. One of our guests told us it has all the hallmarks of a classic satanic panic. We'll begin with the story that was published last month in Spring City's local paper. It's the Sanpete Messenger, published in Manti. The publisher and reporter Suzanne Dean wrote this long, really long, 4,000-word article that laid out the story and its effect on the Benyons in the local community. She says it all began in September of 2022 with Jamin Darcy and his Substack.
He calls it Investigations in Ritual Abuse, IRA. He's been running that over the last 3 years. He is the primary source of all of the allegations and reports of, I don't know what the word is, distasteful activities.
So he basically calls out people who are involved in ritual abuse.
Right.
Has an interesting pen name that he uses.
Yeah, Goel, which is, I've heard some people tell me it stands for Messiah. Others told me it stands for Avenger, but it's a Hebrew word.
Explain the basic claim that Darcy is making about Joe Benyon and Lee Benyon. What is he accusing them of online now to his subscribers?
Sexual abuse of children, you know, life sacrifice of children and adults, murder, cannibalism, desecration of corpses, physical abuse. It kind of goes along the whole spectrum. In his very first post, he said that the goal of the of investigations into ritual abuse is to financially ruin these people, get them put in prison, and get revenge for what they've done and what the Church of Satan has done to supposedly scores and dozens of people.
Do they make a difference between the Church of Satan and the mainstream LDS church? Because one of the things that Darcy mentions in one of these posts is that the goal is to financially cripple the group up and including the LDS church. So what's the connection there?
the way they regard the LDS Church is not super consistent. But I know in one of his posts, he said that the LDS Church of Satan is a church within the LDS Church. And there are different times when he accuses the mainstreaming LDS Church of turning a blind eye to what's going on around them.
There's a one particular moment you mentioned that played out in July of last year, this so-called Jericho March. It was around a courthouse there in Spring City. A man from Nevada blew this shofar, and they walked around the courtyard, had this prayer vigil. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, actually, the courthouse is in Manti.
Okay.
That's 15 miles south of Spring City. And apparently the prayer group visited a number of different locations at Spring City, but one of them was just, you know, 20, 30 feet from the Benyon Pottery Studio. Then after they had left that location, one of the leaders in the Concerned Citizens, these group of people that believe the allegations in these witness statements, came back to the studio and stood on the threshold and dusted his feet. A ritual, I understand it's in the Bible, but also in Mormonism, it's a symbol of contempt. And Joe Bennion caught that on his ring camera.
So a lot of this has played out, as you say, online and in places outside of Utah, but there are believers in the area. Tell us about Ken Krogh.
And the first time I encountered Ken Krogh, I was covering a completely different story, a story about potential multifamily zoning in Spring City. That issue really boiled up. And the mayor decided to set up a committee of citizens to look at all the angles and report the facts and make recommendations. And Ken Krogh was named chairman of that group. And then, you know, subsequently was appointed to fill a vacancy on the city council. And the guy is very bright, very astute. So it just seemed kind of surprising that he is the leader of the anti-Bennion forces.
Is he a Latter-day Saint?
Yes.
Is he in Joe Bennion's ward?
We have two Spring City wards, and I'm not absolutely sure which is in which. I know that when Joe filed for a civil stalking injunction against Ken Krogh, that both of them were released from all their callings because the church authority said that, but he didn't think that they should be, you know, working together, serving the church when they're in litigation against each other. I don't know all the exact rationale there, but one of the allegations in the brief that Joe Bennion's attorneys filed trying to get a civil stalking injunction against Ken Krogh was that Ken Krogh was trying to get Joe Bennion excommunicated from the church.
Joe Bennion's son-in-law, he's representing them in the media and I guess legally, and he told you that this case is driving a wedge in the community. What are you seeing that illustrates that?
Yeah, I think it's kind of subtle, but it's kind of changing the feeling, the environment. Spring City's always been a really kind of tight-knit type community. Back in about the early 2000s, 2006, 2007, somewhere in there, there was a pretty big controversy on whether the historic lot size, everybody had a one-acre lot, and there was a, you know, discussion about allowing people to split those into two lots. And it was really controversial, and the people actually got a referendum, and they put it on the ballot. And Joe Bennion said, you know, and he talked about a longtime resident of the town. He said, you know, I'm on one side, he's on the other. But he rode by my house on his horse the other day. We went out, patted each other on the back, really friendly. You know, this is the way we operate in Spring City. We don't let things get personal. I think that's changed. Now, Joe Bennion said that there's a business in town, and there aren't that many businesses that have asked him not to patronize their business because his image is tarnished. That's contrary to the way the town has operated for 100 years. Mm.
Suzanne Dean, she's the owner and publisher of the Sanpete Messenger. We have a link to her articles on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about what seems to be a satanic panic playing out in Sanpete County. Residents of Spring City have become targets of this elaborate conspiracy narrative pushed by an online crusader who says the region is the center of a ritualistic abuse ring. Now, this is all coming from a case that goes back to the 1990s, and you have to understand that part to get the whole picture. So we asked Salt Lake Tribune reporters Peyton Harkins and Jessica Schreifels to take us through it. Schreifels told us about a man named David Lee Hamblin. He was a therapist who lived in Utah County, and he had a second home in Spring City.
So this story kind of begins with a former patient of David Hamblin, and Hamblin had diagnosed this patient with multiple personality disorder, saying that this stemmed from the patient being ritually sexually abused himself as a child. And at this time, the patient, his name is Brett Bluth. He was an adult when he went to therapy, and he was really struggling, and Hamblin had convinced him that he was sexually abused by satanic worshipers in his childhood, which is why he was struggling currently and why he needed to go to therapy. You know, for the way that Brett kind of retells this now, he thinks that kind of all of this was a lie. He doesn't think that this ever happened to him, and that the point of all of this was so that Hamblin could engage in sexual acts with him during therapy, convincing him that you have to do this sexual act in order to, like, release demons or, like, get rid of this past of yours. And this is, you know, why you have all these different personalities. And so once the patient kind of realized he was being sexually abused in a patient therapy setting, he confronted the therapist and said, you know, if you don't turn yourself into licensors, I'm going to do it. And so eventually Hamblin did go turn himself into licensors, admitted that he had sexual contact with several of his patients, not just this one, and he did lose his license. So this is kind of the first time we hear of any allegations surrounding this kind of central character in the story of any type of wrongdoing or sexual misconduct.
So David Lee Hamblin gets confronted by one of his patients who insists he turns himself into licensing authorities. He does. They revoke his license. So it seems like the story is put on pause there for a time. And then we fast forward, if I have the timeline right, to 2012. This is when We'll Protect Their Identities, some people come out and make some accusations against Hamblin. And this is where the story becomes more elaborate, more lurid. Is it fair to say this is where the story really takes off at that point?
So, yeah, as you mentioned, in 2012, some victims came forward to the Provo police, accused David Hamblin of sexually abusing them. And as part of this report, some of these victims wrote, you know, these very long, elaborate witness statements. And they just go into, like, multiple accounts of ritual sex abuse, child sacrifice, cannibalism, killing babies, these very extreme allegations. And it names a lot of people in these reports. It names David Hamblin. It names the Benyons. It names the Levitts. It names all of these kind of well-known people who, I think at the time, that they did kind of all, they were in the same community together. And so they did know each other in real life. This wasn't just like a random assortment of people. But this document just really laid out, you know, all of these claims, basically saying there is a ritual sex abuse ring, and these are all the horrible things that these people have done to abuse me and other children involved in this kind of community of people.
It's interesting. It involves
the LDS community, too. These were all Latter-day Saints, and local LDS leaders had been implicated in these hundreds of pages of witness statements as well.
Yeah, I mean, there were, I want to say, around 500 pages of witness statements. And the way they're broken down, I mean, you know, it'll be like, you know, location Utah County or location Provo, or, you know, and it'll give a date range, you know, anything from a year to a whatever. And then it just describes in pretty graphic detail everything that these victims, you know, said happened to them. And it was kind of striking to me because, what is it, there's 140-something names that appeared in these documents. In 2010, I think the census said that Spring City's population was like sub 1,000. It was like 990 at that point. And so, I mean, that's nearly, obviously, all of these people weren't from Spring City. But if you think about it like that, I mean, that's 10-ish percent of the population down there in Spring City that's, you know, implicated in these witness statements. That, as far as I can tell, I mean, did they just sort of go away after 2012? I mean, there were no arrests as far as I know, right?
Well, David Hamblin was arrested and charged in connection with this investigation, and he did face some charges for some time, but then prosecutors end up having to drop the case for a lot of evidentiary issues. And so it kind of just goes away for probably a year after that, so maybe 2013, 2014. The case gets dropped, and it kind of just falls out of the public purview. But none of those other people, from what I can tell looking back, were ever really seriously like investigated or looked at as potential suspects. But David Hamblin at that time had been one and had been charged, but then they dropped the case.
So these incredible stories come out, these hundreds of pages that implicate dozens and dozens of people. And there isn't really an investigation into whether or not any of this actually happened. Is it because they were so, I mean, candidly, just unbelievable? I mean, if we're talking baby killings and cannibalism and all of those kinds of things, is it that law enforcement just figured this is insane?
I think that's where it gets hard, you know, trying to piece this all together current time, yeah. You know, from something from 2012. But I do think it's important to note that the charges that Hamblin ended up facing were very, I mean, I don't know how to really phrase this, but kind of like traditional sex abuse charges, you know, perpetrating on one victim in like a home, not a giant ritual, no like cannibalism. It was just kind of more straightforward allegations of sex abuse. And so I think that from what I can tell, looking back at the records, it kind of seemed like the police were trying to parse out, you know, they wanted to keep what they thought they could prove, which
was the ordinary stuff.
Okay. And then the other stuff, it's like, where are the missing babies? Like, you say that babies are being killed. Like, whose babies are they? Like, where's any of the evidence that any of this ever happened? And I don't think that that's something that they could ever find at that time, or I would assume that they would have charged him with those type of crimes instead of what he did end up facing charges for.
Right.
Maybe it's just important to note that the Binions themselves say they've never been interviewed by police based off any of these witness statements. So I don't know. I don't know if you can say that for all the other 100, you know, that were named in these. But I know those two at least haven't been interviewed about it.
So the accusations are out there. And then it sort of goes into this dormancy for a time, it seems. Like the story just sort of sits there. And then we get to 2022. In 2022, the Utah County Sheriff's Office makes this announcement that it is investigating a ritualistic sex abuse ring. What's happening in this part of the story?
I mean, I think from like a journalist perspective, I remember seeing that news release come across to, you know, our email, and everyone was kind of like, what? Like, it seemed so random. It seemed completely out of left field. They were releasing no information about it. They just were saying, we're investigating a ritual sex abuse ring. If anyone has any information, call us. But they wouldn't really answer questions about, like, what are you doing and why now?
And they didn't name who they were investigating or anything.
No, they didn't name who they were investigating. Though, you know, we learn later that David Levitt, who's the county attorney, the Utah County attorney, kind of outs himself as being on this witness list. And that's really where this picks up in the public sphere and, like, just catches like wildfire, and everyone starts like talking about it, and it's, you know, becomes national news.
Okay, so this is where the story takes on that political dimension. The county sheriff is Mike Smith, makes this announcement. doesn't say who he's investigating, but as you said, David Levitt, who at the time was the county attorney and is running to be the county attorney again, says, well, this is what the sheriff is after. He's trying to implicate me in this really old story from a long time ago. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. And again, like, it was so surprising. Like, I remember I covered that county election race and I called David Levitt to ask him about, like, the police, like a normal topic of what you would cover for an election. And he was like, hey, yeah, come to my office in an hour. I'm going to have a press conference. I'm going to ask for the sheriff to resign because he's accusing me of ritual sex abuse.
Wow.
And I'm like, what? Okay. And so I head to Utah County and I'm trying to figure out what is happening here. And so essentially, David Levitt has this pretty dramatic press conference where he calls for the sheriff to resign. He says he's dredging up these old witness statements that say I was involved in, like, cannibalizing children and ritual sex abuse. And, you know, these were never investigated or proven. And the only reason why this is being brought out now is because Sheriff Mike Smith doesn't like me, like, doesn't like me politically. And he was not well liked by the local police at all. And so he thought that the sheriff's goal in announcing this quote unquote investigation was to just bring up a bunch of dirt so he wouldn't win his reelection campaign.
All right, so let me stop for a moment and ask you both, how much of this story, like the particular accusations playing out now for Joe and Lee Benyon in Spring City, or any of the other accusations that have been made out of there, how much of that is making itself into mainstream belief? That is to say, you have a county sheriff in Utah County a couple of years ago who says he's going to engage this investigation into this ritualistic abuse. This year, Republican Representative Ken Ivory was able to get a bill passed that he's been working on for a while about ritualistic abuse. He gets it passed. It's on the governor's office right now. So how much of this is making its way into just sort of the mainstream public discourse and politics?
It's hard to say how much, you know, because I am not on the ground in Spring City or, you know, all this happening, but it does seem to have made its way outside of the little circles that may have, you know, previously believed in these things. Like, you know, when I was reporting on the Binion's request that the attorney general's office, you know, issue a declination letter in their case, you know, to say, you know, once and for all that they didn't have anything to do with this abuse and kind of clear their names, you know, I reached out to Spring City officials just to kind of get a see what they thought. It's a small town. I assume people know each other there.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I heard back from the mayor. His name's Chris Anderson. I wasn't able to include this in my story that I wrote, but, you know, he told me that, you know, this has created, you know, these, you know, different beliefs have created a division in his community. And he, you know, himself has been accused of being a Satanist, he said, because he had a Black Lives Matter sign in his front yard, you know. And so it's like, you know, innocuous things that don't have anything on its face or maybe don't have anything to do with Satanism, you know, are getting people accused of Satanism. And then, yeah, you mentioned, you know, the bill that passed. And then, you know, even, you know, looking back at the response to the article we got, you know, I got an email from somebody that said, you know, satanic panic is a, you know, you might think it's like a buzzword, it's a catchy catchphrase or whatever, but, you know, this person said it hasn't been debunked, it's been covered up. There are people who seem to really believe this stuff.
Is there any reason to believe or take seriously any of those allegations about ritualistic abuse? I mean, was there ever any sense that there was ever something to these accusations of ritualistic abuse?
It's just really hard to say, especially as journalists, you know, we want to look for evidence and things that show that something's true. And looking at a document that's completely unverified, where there hasn't been any type of investigative effort, it's almost impossible to say whether these could be true or not, because the police have not released any documents showing that they ever seriously looked into any of this.
Something I've been thinking of is how police investigate these sort of accusations as more or less one-offs, you know? Hmm. You know, how often are they taking seriously And I'm sure they take seriously, but how often do you get, you know, convictions or even charges in just regular sex abuse cases, you know? And so there's always a high sort of evidentiary threshold for these things. And just sort of your standard cases often don't make it through the criminal justice process. And so, you know, I would hope that when people come forward with something as with allegations as widespread as these were, when you're alleging ritual sex abuse, that police would take those seriously and investigate those. But it almost feels easier to investigate those, because if really the whole community's in on it, it seems it would be easier to find a way out than just a, you know, he said, she said sort of situation.
So where's the story now? Where's this investigation? Where is all of this right now?
I mean, as of February, Sheriff Smith was telling constituents that, you know, this case was real and they're going to keep investigating it.
Still at it, he said, huh?
That's what he said. And then, I mean, I don't, you know, you get into, you know, David Hamblin is still currently facing charges in two counties. I mean, currently, I say, because they've both, at least one of them is going to be dismissed. It's unclear if it's going to be refiled or not, if it can be refiled or not. And the other, I think they've asked for dismissal. And then, you know, his ex-wife, who is the other person who has been charged at all in these allegations, the attorneys in her case are also asking for it to be dismissed right now.
I guess I would just add that, you know, even if this investigation has been ongoing, the police have only charged two people, David Hamblin and his ex-wife. And the victims were similar now as they were when he was charged in 2012. And so all of this, you know, 2 years of political drama and this huge investigation, where he announced this investigation, at the end of the day, it was just still those same people, the most credibly accused people in 2012, that are being accused now today.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Jessica Schreifels, along with Peyton Harkins of the Salt Lake Tribune. Schreifels is an investigative reporter. Harkins covers the criminal justice system. We have a link to the reporting on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We've been talking about the elaborate accusations leveled at some of the people in San Pete County by a Substack blog based in Florida. The claims have now drawn in local residents and threatened to divide the community. Lynn McNeil is a folklorist at Utah State University, and she told us when you look at the key elements and patterns of the Spring City story, it has all the hallmarks of a very particular moral panic.
This situation is 100% classic satanic panic. We've had moral panics, the maybe the more broader concept of a moral panic, forever, for a really long time. We've always had conspiracy. We've always had panic. It's always touched on these sort of potentially moral issues. But the satanic panic as a unique manifestation of that really hit home in the 1980s in the USA. And this is something we've seen discussed in popular culture, in the news, in think pieces from the 1980s until today. Some people say the 1980s satanic panic never ended. But what we see here in Spring City, Utah, is just a perfect representation, encapsulation of a satanic panic.
Textbook, bog standard case. It's you yes. Look at the characteristics, they're all there.
Shockingly similar, in fact, to some of the specific cases that we saw in the 1980s, the McMartin preschool trial, which was really the big headline maker at the time, where a group of adults were being accused of satanic ritual abuse perpetrated against children, and just the over-the-top inflammatory descriptions of things being done, the use of recovered memories as the evidence for these things happening, the tying in of specific real details, but that in fact are evidence of nothing, just unbelievably similar.
It's interesting the way they graft onto these panics, or seem to anyway, the modern moment of anxiety or turmoil or whatever it might be. But they also have a background, a history. One of the things you mentioned to us was that there's a kind of a core element. You say almost all of them are connected to this legend from antiquity about yes. blood libel. Say more about that.
The blood libel legend, as it has now come to be known, truly is this story that we can date back into antiquity. It has existed, we can assume, as long as people have existed and as long as people have identified insiders and outsiders, or the morally right and the morally wrong. And so we see this legend, the blood libel legend, being used by one group to disenfranchise or defame or insult another group, to the extent where we can hate them so easily and openly that we need no longer consider them people. The classic manifestation of the blood libel legend was the accusation against Jewish people yeah. that they were kidnapping young Christian children and cannibalizing them and abusing them, murdering them. I mean, what we start to see over time is that this is the story we tell when we want to imagine a group of people as morally reprehensible. We tell the story that they are taking our children. They are literally extracting their own power or essence. And we see that in the use of children in these sort of black mass type Eucharistic rituals that we hear from the past. We see it in the accusations of satanic ritual abuse and cannibalism today. We see it in the QAnon theories of people kidnapping children and trafficking them to take their adrenochrome. It's the same story, just mapped through different time periods with different players based on who are we looking to vilify in the worst way possible. And we've been doing it for literal centuries.
It's interesting the terminology you have mentioned to us that gets at the kind of the characters in the way a moral panic plays out. One of them is what scholars call moral entrepreneurs. What is the role of the moral entrepreneur? How does that what's the mechanics of how that works there?
This is really interesting. When we look at these sorts of moral panics, these archetypes and motifs start to emerge. And we start to see that there's really these key elements that are needed for a moral panic to happen. And it's usually some constellation of mass media, some idea of moralizing or controlling culture. But there's this key component that scholars refer to as the moral entrepreneur. And really what this is an individual or maybe a group who makes it their job, who campaigns to eradicate some sort of immoral or threatening behavior. So this is the individual person who makes it their calling to get the word out there, to send other people, galvanize other people to join in the cause, maybe to harass the people who are being pigeonholed as another key element of a moral panic, the folk devil, the person who is perpetrating or is said to be perpetrating all these terrible atrocities. And we see the necessity of those two pieces. There needs to be an accused, but there also needs to be an accuser.
So the folk devil is the accused. And one of the things you've talked about is how this plays out in small communities, that it's often the person or people who aren't so conventional to a place, the people who stand out. Are these the folk devils? And is Joe Bennion fitting into that template here?
Yeah. So when we see a moral panic of any kind, satanic panic or otherwise, one of the key elements there is this sort of anchorless, swirling anxiety, this fear, this sense that something is wrong, the world isn't right, there are bad people, there are bad things happening. And one of the things we know about the human brain is that it wants to anchor that. Yeah. It wants to find a target just for the sake of coherency. We are driven to focus that anxiety, that fear, that stress onto something, because then we can define it, we can identify it, we could potentially eliminate it. If nothing else, we can name it. And that's where that concept of folk devil comes from. And anytime we have that swirling, ambiguous anxiety and we are looking for a place to put it, we're going to look for the people who already stand out. And this is an interesting thing because the people against whom these accusations are made are not, for the most part, people who are wildly aberrant from society. They're not excessively deviant, especially in a small community, especially in a overall pretty homogenous small community. The difference, the aberration that can cause someone to be the focus of this might be incredibly minute. It could be someone's political leanings. It could be someone's social interests. We saw this, you know, in American history in the Salem witch trials, women who were just slightly off the mainstream, maybe they were widowed or lived alone, suddenly were the target of truly bizarre, over-the-top accusations, and absolutely, in many cases, paid the price for that. So when we think of a folk devil, it's a role that's created rather than a role that anyone actually occupied on their own prior to the panic. It's a person who unfortunately was just standing out enough that when that laser pointer of panic was looking for something to settle on, there they were, 2 inches in front of everyone else.
So when Joe Bennion and Lee Bennion fly a pride flag,
yeah,
that's the attention that it might draw.
Yeah, something that small, you know, and we see little things like that in a predominantly conservative area, yeah. Something small like having a pride flag. Does that make you a bizarre and unknowable person? No. But does it just slightly set you apart from the rest of the community in a visibly noticeable way? Yeah, it does.
So I get the blood libel part, like it's ancient lineage here. But how does it map onto the current, like, political moment? And by that I mean, does it connect with some of these extreme, you know, political ideologies, not just on the right, but maybe even on the left? Like, how do they map onto those things today?
You know, I think the best map that we see is just in the unbelievable dichotomy, the divisiveness that is here. Everything is pushing everyone to the farthest, most extreme understandings of the people we disagree with. And it's doing us an incredible disservice. I think when most people envision the people who disagree with them politically right now, what they are envisioning is a caricature, an absolute extremity. And we find that that is enabled by all of our intermediary communicative technology. So things like the internet, social media, initially thought to be a unifying force. These are going to connect us around the world. It turns out that what they can also do is provide just enough of an anonymizing shield between us and other people that we forget the normalcy of others at times. So we're more ready to believe in these truly over-the-top bizarre claims. And it takes a wild and crazy political landscape for them to take hold.
Is the fact that this is an LDS community, is that relevant to this story? In the sense that there is a big institution here, yeah, that is, could sort of be a framework for these stories? Like, is there a Mormon angle here in some way?
I think there is on more than one level. Anytime there is a cohesive community with a dominant moral ideology, it creates the opportunity for folk devils even better, because there's such a clear, shared, constructed sense of morality,
yeah,
that it amplifies even those very small and very slight aberrations from it. So I think that any religious community is set up more for this kind of moral panic, a satanic panic, than another one is. But I think in another, maybe more nuanced way, the Church of Latter-day Saints at large often perceives a sense of persecution against itself historically. And here we see a subdivision of that. These particular accusations make specific reference to the LDS Church of Satan, which is not a thing, yeah, but which sounds like enough of a thing that it gives people who identify as, you know, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, not of Satan, something to oppose. And it creates an immediate othering within a community that already identifies with feeling othered. And it sort of just becomes these even more subtle gradations of who's in the moral right.
There's one kind of odd detail that I feel like I have to ask you about. And it may be apropos of nothing to the larger story, but it's this particular detail in the story playing out in Spring City where Joe Bennion, of course, is a potter. And it's something you've noticed about the way Joe refers to his kiln as
yes.
a kill. What is that about? What do you find interesting about that little detail?
First off, the use of the word kill for kiln with an N at the end is well known among linguists. This is actually a pronunciation that we have record of dating back into the Middle Ages. Mm. Obviously, now in English, the more common word is kiln with the N on the end. But the use of that older form of the word, kill, is actually now most commonly found among professional ceramicists and potters.
Yeah.
So it makes perfect sense that someone who makes their living as a potter would refer to this tool that they use as a kill rather than as a kiln. But in the context of the Satanic Panic, this factual instance becomes this enormous piece of evidence. Oh, if he's not out there committing all of these acts of ritual abuse, then why would he call his kiln a kill? Mm. Easy answer. Most potters do. But this is something that we see with moral panics, with conspiracy theories, is that one of the things that keeps them going is that among the many pieces of rumor and legend and hearsay that form the cloud of the conspiracy, among those things are facts that then appear to lend credence to the rest of the totally unverifiable, often disprovable elements that are a part of this. And we saw similar things in, you know, the satanic panics of the 1980s. A lot of people have, you know, artwork in their homes that includes stars. The minute there's a satanic panic, those stars become pentagrams. You turn that picture upside down, it's an inverted pentagram. That's the sign of Baphomet. There we've got Satanists. And it's truly bizarre, because is it a fact that some people have artwork depicting stars in their home? Yep. Does that make them Satanists? Absolutely not. Do some potters refer to their kilns as kills? Yep. Does that mean they are killing people in them? Absolutely not.
You know, the reporters from the Salt Lake Tribune we talked to this week mentioned that I think it was the mayor of the city has said that this story is really dividing the community now. And I guess that's one of the characteristics, right? This is the potential for something like this to happen. It can really tear apart a place.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and we see this happening on a broad scale, this divisiveness, but you map it over the context of a small community like Spring City. And the real horror of something like this shows itself, because these aren't abstract concepts anymore. These aren't politicians a continent away doing these things. These are your neighbors.
Yeah.
These are your friends. And the impact of something like this really can't be underestimated. The hallmark of a moral panic is exaggeration and distortion. These are qualities that are known to be taking place. And when you look back, even on thoroughly discredited and disproven moral panics, what people remember are the exaggerated and distorted parts. The slow, careful process of proving these things false does not stick in our brains as thoroughly as the accusations themselves. So there can be long-standing division that grows out of something like this. It can be difficult for a community to recover if they are not equally devoted to the recovery as they were to the promotion of the panic itself.
So even when a panic like this burns itself out and fades away, it doesn't really ever entirely go away in some ways.
Sadly, no. We remember it and we revisit it, and we hopefully, as a culture, revisit it in thoughtful ways. We can see in television shows, Stranger Things, bringing back the moral panic of the 1980s around Dungeons and Dragons and different styles and types of music. We contend with it. We remember it. But we tend to remember the panic more than we remember the slow fade from that panic. And that's a tough thing to be branded with.
Dr. Lynn McNeil, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Lynn McNeil, she's an associate professor of folklore in the English department at Utah State University. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1, also on Instagram at Radio West. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.